Hey, welcome to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative professionals and entrepreneurs looking to grow by learning new things, getting inspired, and breaking down the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to episode 89, Interview with Justin Kerr. Justin is a designer for both print and web and helps his customers solve problems with design. In this episode, we talk about his journey from starting out in design to where he is at today, the importance of listening and good writing in the design process, how he approaches learning new things, and why he loves yard sales and flea markets. Show notes for this episode are available at gwtw.co/89. Are you passionate and motivated to make the world a better place with your company, product, or culture, and wonder how you're going to market your efforts? Chris Martin Studios is a video production company that produces videos of heart, edge, and fearlessness for those who dare to build a better world. Head to chrismartinstudios.com to see the latest goods produced for people just like yourself. And while you're there, sign up for my weekly email newsletter, The Curiosity Lab. It's a great way to stay connected with Chris Martin Studios and meet awesome people changing the world. All right, you ready for this interview with Justin? Take it away, interviewer Chris. Justin, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. Why don't you start by introducing yourself and share a little bit about what you do?
Absolutely. Well, I guess it would be hard for me to define myself in only one category. So I've been a professional designer for about 25 years. I've been a husband for about 26 years, and I've been a dad for about 20. So that I think probably make up the three biggest components of who I am.
Very cool.
I grew up in the Midwest, in Ohio, on Lake Erie, which is a great place to grow up, and then came east to go to school in Rhode Island at RISD, and that's where I met my wife, and just have never left Rhode Island. So now I can't technically classify myself as a native Rhode Islander, but I've lived here long enough that I do give directions by where things used to be. So evidently that makes you a local.
Nice. That's awesome. What got you into design?
I've always loved to, draw, and I've loved art since I was a kid. And growing up as an only child, I had a lot of time to myself. So a lot of time to, explore that, and just draw. And as I grew up, I thought, well, I wanted to be an architect because that looked really cool. And then I had a little bit of trouble getting my head around math and science. And I'm like, maybe I should look for a related field. So graphic design seemed to be a good area where I could, still express myself. And I was, disappointed I couldn't become an architect, so I married one instead, and I figured that was a good alternative.
That's brilliant.
You get it through osmosis.
Yeah.
But as far as design, I'm one of those people that just loves to look at like letter forms. I love typography. Mm. I love to see how form and content come together, and with color, there's just something about it that I enjoy. And when it's done right, it can be a very beautiful and inspiring thing. So it's something that, has been with me for a long time. A lot of people I went to school with, they were in my major, and they ended up not working in their major, or they switched majors. And I've just kind of been on this one track for probably since junior high.
Oh, wow. So when you went to Rhode Island School of Design, you knew exactly why you were going and what you were getting into.
Yeah, pretty much. Everybody has to go through freshman foundation and learn all the basic stuff and, life drawing and two-dimensional design. But yeah, I was pretty clear on where I wanted to go.
Wow.
And I had friends that changed majors three or four times while they were there. And that's fine. I mean, it is one of those periods of life where you kind of figure out what you want to do and what you like and what you don't like. But I never really deviated. I mean, I appreciate other majors. Like when I was in my senior year, I ended up collaborating with a guy in film video to do my senior project. So we split the difference. It was his senior project, my senior project, and we created a 22-minute documentary on design.
Oh, wow.
And so it was really cool to be able to, you know, go with him and do these video shoots and then, you know, kind of put this whole thing together and script it out. And then, of course, you know, this was in the days before digital, so we shot about, oh gosh, I think we shot about 40 hours worth of video, and we had to edit it down to 22 minutes. So we just spent 2 weeks locked in this little room editing this stuff, and it was an experience.
That's awesome. Oh, and being before digital, it must have just been a nightmare. I mean, are you talking about VHS and linear editing and all that?
Oh yeah, we shot everything on 8mm video tape, videotape. Yeah. And yeah, linear editing, and then we had to go to another department in the school to a guy who knew broadcast titling so that he could apply all the titles. And it was all just analog and manual. And I mean, it was a great experience. I'm all about learning analog, you know, that existed before digital. Like I love letterpress, you know, and actually putting hot metal type together and seeing how that works, because I think it gives you an appreciation for the digital version of it. And I think video is the same way. It's like if you are familiar with how it was done before digital, it really gives you an appreciation and a grounding in it that I think you don't have if you come to it and all you know is digital.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think design, especially graphic design, there's such a history in terms of the analog components that seem to be making a comeback right now. Especially in this part of the world, in this part of the country, you know, it's kind of the cool niche thing to do in Portland.
Yeah, I've noticed in Providence, you know, where I live, that you know, there's places that do letterpress, you know, that you can have short runs of things made, and there's a couple of different sign painting companies, you know, that will go out and do the old fashioned just paint on the side of the building or on glass on the front door. So a lot of the crafts, you know, visual art crafts seem to be making a comeback. So I guess it makes sense because, you know, vinyls come back and craft, you know, everything is craft now. There's a place not too far from where I live called the Steel Yard, and it's a big metal foundry, and you can go down and learn how to be a blacksmith, and they'll train you how to make things out of metal and forge them, and it's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. Wow. So when you graduated from college, did you jump right into running your own business, or did you go work for someone?
Yeah, working for myself is actually a fairly recent adventure for me. I spent a good deal of my career working for other people. Actually, when I graduated, I couldn't find any work in design at all, and I ended up roofing houses for a while. So that was humbling. you know, you come out of school and you think you know everything, and you know, you end up roofing houses, and you realize, wow, I really don't know anything about life or work. So, but I did eventually find a job with a printer, and which was a really good job to get as an entry-level designer because it taught me a lot about production. And I learned, you know, how the sausage gets made, because it wasn't all just, you know, doing the design. It was, okay, how do you produce this now? So I learned a lot of good things about production. And then, you know, from there I went to work for a small graphic design studio and learned a lot of things there. I mean, they kind of threw me into situations that I had little to no experience in, and they said, well, we need someone to go art direct this photo shoot. Go do it. I'm like, I don't know what to do. So, but you learn on the fly, you know, and I was fortunate in that respect because then I was able to take that and parlay it into my next job. So when I went to work for a university And I was able to say, well, you know, I do graphic design, but I can also art direct photo shoots. And they're like, oh, great. You know, we've got like four different campuses and we need someone to go art direct these photo shoots for our admissions catalogs. So I got to do that. So it just kept sort of building the snowball as I went along and adding different experiences and different skills to it. And you know, it's been really sort of just a slow process of building up the skill set. But my biggest chunk of my career is actually working for a web development company called Newfangled. And I know you recently interviewed Chris Butler, who's the COO there. And I started working for them in 2000. And again, it was one of those things where I was sort of thrown into a situation where I didn't have a tremendous amount of experience. I had been doing print design for my whole career up to that point. And I was at a birthday party for a friend, and he had a mutual friend that we both knew. And this guy said, hey, do you want to build websites? I'm like, I don't know anything about the web. I know how to send email. I know how to receive email. That's the only thing I know about the internet. And he said, don't worry about it. He says, come talk to my boss. And so I did, and you know, brought my portfolio and everything. They said, yeah, this looks good. Do you want to come work for us? And I said, well, I don't really know anything about how to design for the web. He said, don't worry about it. We can train you how to do that. We just need somebody who, you know, knows design, you know, and has an eye. It's like, all right. So, you know, in 2000, I started learning how to design for the web, and I did that for 16 years. And a lot of things changed over that period of 16 years.
Oh, yeah.
you know, when I began, I think it was just on the verge of like CSS and, you know, all of the things that people are familiar with now. But then it was all just custom pages strung together with links. And there was a lot of flash and just, you know, it was really kind of a wild, wild west at that time. Because in 2000, I mean, the web had only been around for about 5 years in its, you know, sort of present form. So it was a big learning curve, but it's been great. And so about a little over a year ago, I had an opportunity to go into business for myself. And I took advantage of it because it's something that had been in the back of my head for a while. And I thought, am I going to wait till I'm 70 to do this? It's like, what am I waiting for? You know, it's like, so I decided, you know, I would jump out of the plane and go into this world of, you know, self-employment and entrepreneurship. And so far it's been really good. You know, I think the advantage that I had was that I did have a lot of experience already. I did have some contacts. I did have, you know, a little bit of a network. So it wasn't like I was coming into it cold or totally inexperienced. But I have spent the last year just learning how to really network and learning how to market myself, which is something you know, when you're working for somebody else, you don't really need to know because somebody else takes care of that, and somebody takes care of the accounting, and someone else takes care of, you know, the sales and all that stuff. And when you're self-employed, it's all on you, you know. So I've learned a tremendous amount in the last year of just sort of the business end of it, and it's been fun. I mean, I really do enjoy sort of setting my own schedule and, you know, being able to look for projects that I think are interesting and, you know, that I'd like to pursue. It has allowed me to get back into print, which I really hadn't done much of in the last 16 years. You know, I've been able to do some trade show graphics. I've been able to do some books. I've been able to do, you know, a lot of stuff that I had to kind of put aside for a while. So it's been neat getting back into that.
That's awesome. One of the things that I'm hearing as you're explaining and sharing your journey has been your willingness to say yes to things when they arise, especially things that maybe you're not entirely comfortable with or inexperienced with. So, you know, how did you, is saying yes just something that you naturally do? And it's just an extension of who you are? Or did you realize when you're roofing houses that you have to say yes to those things?
You know, it's funny because if you ask my wife, she would tell you that I'm somewhat of a cautious person, that if, you know, I deliberate things before I decide what to do, and I'm not maybe as spontaneous as the next person. But I guess my willingness to say yes is that I like to learn new things and I like new experiences. And I figure, you know, worst case scenario, I try something, it doesn't work out. You know, what have you lost? Well, you know, you really haven't lost much. So to me, it seems like a low risk factor to say yes to something. You know, that's a different thing than trying to convince somebody you're qualified in an area when you're really not. I'm brutally honest with people when they say, you know, can you do this? It's like, well, I've never done it before, but I'm willing to give it a shot. Yeah. And if they're willing to take a chance on that, then, hey, great. Maybe it'll work out for the both of us, you know?
Do you find that having a really good portfolio along with that, you know, openness and confidence is what really leads people to say yes?
Yeah, it's definitely having a good portfolio is an asset. One of the difficult things about putting together a portfolio, though, is knowing, you know, what to put in, what to leave out. And from a client side of it too, oftentimes when a client says, well, I want to see your portfolio, what they're looking for is they're looking for the exact solution that they have a problem to. Mm. And it's rare that they're going to see something that is going to answer their exact question. Yeah. Hopefully when they're looking at my work, they're seeing that, you know, the work that I do is at a professional level, it's competent. It has a certain look and feel to it, and that it shows that I work through a certain process to get to a solution. I mean, the other drawback about a portfolio is you're seeing end results. Mm-hmm. And the end result is only a small portion of the experience of working with a client. You know, you don't see the conversations that begin the process. You don't see the iteration of, you know, the concept as it's developing. You don't see a lot of things that go into it, which is one of the reasons, I guess, on my site, I have, you know, a few case studies, and I try to show process wherever possible because I want, you know, prospective clients to understand that, you know, this isn't like a vending machine where you go up, you put your money in, you pull the lever, and, you know, out comes your candy bar. There's a process to this, and there's a certain inherent value to it. And so when they hire me, what they're getting is not just a final product, but they're getting a whole process. And hopefully that's something that comes across.
It definitely comes across. And one of the things that I love is you wrote a blog post about good design does not cost as much as you think, where you talk about, you know, the value and you break it down into really tangible areas. And I just thought that was really interesting because you're taking something that can be so subjective, you know, good design, bad design, whatever it is, but you're saying this is actually what goes into my work. It's an inclusive process. It's a positive experience. It's personal service. It's a good investment. And so did you just kind of fall into how you describe that, or has that evolved over the last year as you've learned about networking and marketing yourself?
I think it's definitely evolved over time in regards to how I think about it. It's definitely evolved over the last year as I've tried to figure out how to explain that to other people, you know, how to market my services in a way that it makes sense to somebody. Like, you know, you were, one of your previous podcasts, you were talking about, you know, ditching being clever for being clear. And I thought it was great because it's one of the biggest challenges is being clear in when you're describing what you do and being clear in describing your process, rather than simply trying to be clever. And so I think a lot of, you know, the way I work and the way I explain it to people has definitely evolved as I've had to learn how to market myself. Mm-hmm. You know, and the, you know, just the aspect of the personalized service, you know, when I met my wife, I didn't really have a good idea of what Asian food was. I thought, you know, Asian food came in a box that said Le Choy on the front of it. Now, my wife has the benefit of being Asian, so she introduced me to the world of Asian cuisine the way it should be experienced, and it completely opened my eyes to, you know, how sophisticated and wonderful it is. Mm-hmm. And I'll never go back to Le Choy. You know, it's, you know, once you've had authentic Sapporo ramen, you will never look at a brick of Ichiban ever again. It's just two completely different things. And, you know, so hopefully what I'm bringing to my clients is, you know, more like the authentic ramen and not the, you know, the brick that's in the convenience store. Mm-hmm. That's the hope anyway.
Yeah. Well, and I think that the perception that I get as I look at your website, as I read the testimonials, as I read your case studies, is that you are bringing that personal service. And one of the ways that consistently comes up, and I loved seeing this in that testimonial, was he's mastered the art of listening. How have you learned the art of listening?
That's a good question. I can't really point to a you know, a point in time and say, well, this is when I learned how to listen. But I think it comes out of, I think good listening comes out of empathy. Good listening involves really trying to understand the person that you're speaking with. Not just listening so that you can formulate a response, but listening in a way that you really are trying to understand who they are and where they're coming from, you know, maybe where some of their pain points are, you know, like what's bothering them. Mm-hmm. So that you can have empathy, you know, so that you can really relate to them on a deeper level. You know, you've heard of the 7-minute rule in conversation.
No.
Well, in any given conversation with somebody, especially if somebody you've met for the very first time, you've got about 7 minutes of news, sports, and weather, very light talk. Now, at that 7-minute mark, somebody has to make a commitment to go deeper into that conversation. And either you're going to end the conversation at 7 minutes, or someone's going to take a risk and go, you know, ask a question about you, like, well, tell me about what you do. Why do you like doing what you do? And then you go to that deeper level. Mm-hmm. And so I think good communication gets past the 7 minutes and gets into the deeper stuff of really trying to understand the other person. And in regards to servicing clients, you know, and helping them with their design issues, it's important, because if you can't understand where they're coming from and you can't kind of get inside their head, mm-hmm. you're really never going to be able to come up with a good solution. Mm. You know, so you really, one of the things that I do is I always have an initial sit down with the client before, you know, we even talk about contracts or you know, projects or anything like that, because I want to get to know them. I want to get to know them as people. I want to get to know their business, and I really have to be able to try to see it from their side. Because once we get into the project, I'm trying to view everything through their lens. Hmm. And without good communication, you're never going to get there.
Hmm. How is that met from the client's perspective? Because, you know, I've had those moments where, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, let's just sit down and talk about who you are and what you do. And some people are just like, dude, I just need this done. Can we just get the job done? You know, and it's like, that's one response to that. And, you know, what other responses have you got, and how do you stick to your guns of saying, I'm sorry, this is really the process of working with me?
Yeah, it's not easy. I've had the similar response of, you know, someone not really understanding why that's important and just saying, no, I just need a logo. It's like, you know, and so I think you have the opportunity at that point to say, well, okay, maybe we're not a good fit, you know, and you try to refer them to someone that you think might be a good fit for them. I've also had the other side of that where you get so deep into conversation, you realize you're not talking about the project anymore. You know, it's like you're getting someone's life story, And while it's great, it's like you do have to kind of keep things on track. So, you know, it kind of runs the gamut between I really don't want to talk at all to, you know, let's spend a week together so I can tell you my entire life. But I do think the initial conversation does give you the opportunity to figure out, is this going to be a good fit? And that's an important thing to know up front before you take on any project is, you know, I think it's probably a little bit of hubris to think that you can take on any project in any client because there are good fits and there are not so good fits. So I think the conversation serves as a way of finding out, can we work together? Because chemistry counts as much as anything in any given client relationship. And if there's decent chemistry or at least workable chemistry, and you know, you can agree to work on the project, then it's probably a good fit. If there's no chemistry or they don't understand your process or they don't understand where you're coming from, it would probably be more of a headache to take on that project than it would be to simply say, well, I need the money right now. I should really take this project. and yes, I have turned down projects. I have, you know, in as gracious way as possible, told clients that, you know, we're probably not a good fit, but let me see if I can recommend you to someone that could help you out.
Yeah, that's cool. What do you look for when you're meeting with a client and you're sitting down and talking with them? How has that changed and evolved as you've kind of, you know, met more companies, met with more business owners, and worked through, I guess, the sales process?
That's another good question. Well, I think the project itself is definitely one of the things that, you know, I evaluate. You know, there may be a project that comes across my desk that I think, wow, I'd really like to work on this project because it's either going to provide an experience that I've never had before, or it's something that I feel passionate about. And I may pursue it pretty hard based on that. You know, it's just like, I really want to work on this project. Or I think that I can really help this person out. I've done a lot of work for nonprofits, and, you know, many of them don't have the budgets that a lot of other organizations do, but the work that they do is just as important. So I have oftentimes, you know, done work for them simply because I believe in what they're doing and I want them to have a professional look and I want them to be taken seriously and I want them to be able to, you know, generate either resources or donations or whatever it is that their goal is, to be able to do that by presenting themselves well. And if I can help them do that, then I want to do that. You know, and I get myself into trouble a little times with cash flow when I take on those projects. But, you know, it's definitely one of the things that is a pull for me is to say, wow, okay, I can see where you want to be and where you are now, and I think I can help you get from where you are to where you want to be. You know, let me help you do that. Yeah. Of course, there's chemistry. I mean, there's some clients that I just really enjoy working with. You know, we'll do a Skype call or an audio call to work over a project, and we must spend the first 20 minutes just talking about, well, what'd you do last weekend? Oh, that sounds really cool. You know, or how are your kids? And you know, you just enjoy talking to them as people. Mm-hmm. And that makes a lot of difference when you're working with them on a project. I think one of the keys is, and this is something that's sort of been a philosophy of mine for a while, is that people don't really care how much you know until they know how much you care. Mm. So it doesn't matter how brilliant you are, how skilled you are, how experienced you are. If the person you're speaking with, or even if it's a prospective client, if they don't think that you care about them as people or you care about their project, it doesn't really matter how great you are, you know, as a designer or how knowledgeable you are. But once they know that you care about them as a person, you care about the project, they're much more open to your suggestions and recommendations. You know, and when it does come to a point where you have to try to guide them in a certain direction in regards to design, they're much more open to that than, you know, if they feel like you're just here to provide a service and you don't really care about them as an individual.
That's an amazing point. Thank you for that. That's just, I really like that. It really makes you think about just the human connection, the fact that, yeah, you're working with the business, but you're working with real people in that business.
Sure.
And trying to find that humanity sometimes in corporations and, you know, big organizations can be a challenge.
Yeah. And I've had the opportunity to work inside of large organizations and also work for them, and it can get very complicated. I've had projects where, you usually try to have a single point of contact for a project. And I've had projects where that single point of contact is 8 different people. And it can get very, very complicated managing that and managing egos and managing, likes and dislikes. So, yeah.
One of the things that you have on your blog that is really good is you point out bad design and poor stock photography usage. Now, what's great about it is not that you just point it out, but you actually show how you would improve it. And I think that's great because it sets you apart from the crowd. You're not just a critic, you're actually doing something constructive where you're saying, this is why it's not good and this is how you improve it. Why did you, or how did you come up with that idea? Because that's ingenious.
Well, thanks. I didn't really think it was that unique, so maybe I should patent it, but try to another income stream there.
There you go.
Well, I think it just comes mostly out of my personality. And my wife or my kids will tell you, we'll be somewhere and I'll see something that's just, has bad letter spacing. And I'll say, look at that letter spacing. It's like, it's horrible. And, if I were to do this, I would probably move this over here and do that. And, I think I'd probably bore them to death with those kind of scenarios. But if I see something that I think I could improve on, I wish I could, get a hold of it and improve on it. And it's not because I'm some sort of design snob, but it's like, I see design as a way of effective communication. And if you've got a sign that is poorly letter spaced, you're working against that communication. You're working against being clear and being precise. And I just have this sort of innate desire to, have design communicate well and clearly. And when I see it done poorly, I just want to fix it. I've got a couple of things on my to-do list as far as blog posts, and one of them is, I occasionally will rent Zipcars. I don't know if you're familiar mm-hmm. with Zipcars. We got them all over our neighborhood, and they're great, if you just need to go somewhere, a client meeting or whatever. And I got in this SUV the other day, and I'm looking at the dashboard, and it's horrible. So as I'm driving down the road, I keep looking at this going, why doesn't this work? Why isn't this well laid out? And how I would change it differently. And so I got my phone out and I'm snapping pictures, and I'm really fortunate I didn't get into a wreck, because I wanted to make sure that I got like the speedometer reading that didn't just say zero. So I have to be moving while I do this. And I'm like, I'm going to die trying to do this. But I'm looking at this layout and, thinking about, well, if this was over here, that would be clear. And what's the most important thing on this dashboard? Because this is not something you're going to stare at. You're going to glance down for maybe 1 second or half a second as you're driving along. What information do you need to have in front of you immediately? What is important here? And what is just decoration? So I'm always looking at stuff, trying to figure out, is this working? Is it communicating clearly? Is it doing the job it's supposed to do? And, design is obviously one of the ways that you can help something communicate effectively, whether it's a layout on a dashboard of a car, or it's a piece of signage, or it's a logo, or it's a catalog or a website. I guess that's, for me, that's always kind of the goal. I've had, another one that I'm thinking of putting up soon is just a comparison of And this kind of plays off another blog post I had on what's the difference between going to Fiverr and buying a $5 logo and going to a designer and having something developed. And so, you know, there's just on the surface, you think, well, there's really not a lot of difference between this one that you could purchase for $5 and one that you came up with. But like I said before, there's a lot behind it. And, you know, a friend of mine, James Kwan, who owns his own design and marketing agency, said something the other day that I thought was brilliant, because we were kind of talking shop and talking about identity development and logos and branding. And he said, yeah, when we approach our clients, he says, we like to tell them that when we develop their identity, that it's going to be a system, not a stamp. You know, so you have to think about it as this whole system that is going to help you brand yourself effectively and market yourself effectively. And it's not just a rubber stamp that you're going to, you know, pop on a business card or on a piece of letterhead. So I thought that was a brilliant statement. And I told him, I said, I'm stealing that from you, because I think that's that absolutely, you know, encapsulates it, that you are, you're creating, you're developing a system, and that and there's more complexity to that than just throwing something together with a mark and a piece of type.
I appreciate the way you talk about this too, because, you know, you're saying that phrases like effective communication, and you're describing problem solving without saying problem solving, and you're talking about user experience without talking about UX, and I appreciate that, because like I'm ready to sign on the dotted line right now. Like I get what you're selling when you're talking about it, because you put me in the position of I'm sitting in front of the dash now. I can see what you're talking about, and that's powerful.
No, thanks. I'm tried very hard not to be dropping jargon today, because I'm not a big fan of it. But you know, sometimes you have to utilize it to, you know, to talk shop with people. But yeah, it's I try as much as possible just use plain words, because that's how people speak.
Well, and that's just great, because it gets you into the mindset of people that aren't interested in jargon or have no desire to know how the sausage is made and the way that we communicate that. You know, it's just problem solving and effective communication.
Yeah. I mean, one of the drawbacks of jargon is that oftentimes designers will use it to try to impress a client or baffle them, you know, to make themselves look good. And it's like, well, you know, I'm not really interested in making myself look good at the expense of the client. It's like, I'm here to help them. So if I can relate to them as a person, I think I'm going to be far more effective as a designer than if I'm trying to impress them and make them think that I'm some, you know, guru. That's really, that doesn't serve them. And ultimately, it doesn't serve me very well, you know. So that, I guess that's, you know, probably one of the reasons I don't spend a lot of time spouting jargon.
So one of the ways to grow as a designer is obviously in the technical aspects of being able to draw well and use Photoshop and all that. But how do you learn and grow in like areas of ideas or stories or ways to look at the world? How do you learn in those areas?
Well, it's, you know, there's not a single resource, you know, for that. I mean, one of the things that I like about getting inspiration is getting it from different sources. So, you know, I may be watching a movie, or I may be taking a walk outside, and I'll see something or I'll hear something that inspires me. So, you know, you make a little note or you put a voice memo on your phone for later. You know, there's nothing worse for me anyway than, you know, trying to go to one of these best of design sites and gain inspiration from them. Because, I mean, while it's wonderful looking work, it doesn't, you know, it's kind of an echo chamber in a way. It really doesn't inspire me to think differently. But if, you know, if I'm playing a game with one of my kids, or I'm just sitting out in the backyard, you know, poking at the fire pit, that's usually when things will sort of come into focus, or I'll have an idea, or I'll be able to think about a project in a different way or a problem in a different way. So I try to have as many different sources of sort of inspirational input. I love reading about and hearing about other designers and the way they think. There's a tremendous series on Netflix right now called Abstract. And there's about 8 different episodes, and each one features on a different artist or designer. And I love it because I just love to see how other people approach problems and how they think and what their inspiration is and what their background is, like where they came from. Because, you know, who you are as a designer is shaped a lot by, you know, where you grew up and how you grew up and who were the people around you as you were sort of developing your craft. So I always find it interesting to see how that happened for other people, you know, where they've come from and why they do the work they do.
Yeah. Which episode was your favorite?
That's tough. I mean, I was drawn to the graphic design one only because that's, you know, my field, but I also, the one on architecture, I forget the names.
That's okay.
But the one on architecture was amazing, just the way that he thought about space and the way he thought about people being in that space, you know, was, you know, just his thought process was incredible. And, I mean, I enjoyed all of them, but, you know, even the one, the very first one on the Illustrator, and just the way that he approached his craft. And he would just, you know, he has this table and he lays the papers out and he just starts, you know, drawing with a brush or with a pen. And just watching that process is, you know, is really amazing. I mean, one of the books that I used to read to my kids when they were little was Harold and the Purple Crayon. Which, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's a great little series of books. It's just this little kid with a purple crayon, and he draws his environments, and he draws his world, and they come to life. And it's just, I just find that sort of thing really, really amazing, because I think, you know, that's kind of how I would like to be able to do what I do, is to just take a very simple tool and be able to create something where something was not before.
So if you were to draw your world with a purple crayon right now, what would it look like?
Well, let's see. It would look like better cash flow.
great answer.
But I think it would also, you know, it would definitely involve, you know, the things that I appreciate about life now. You know, I appreciate, you know, the different communities that I'm a part of, you know, whether it's the design community or whether it's my, you know, the community of the friends and family. I think it would definitely be populated with the people that I enjoy being around and the people that I enjoy interacting with. Because to me, it's like that's where life kind of springs from. I mean, I'm a big gadget guy. I love gadgets. And, you know, I spend a lot of time trolling Indiegogo looking for like the latest cool thing. And I've, you know, so I'm definitely a victim of that. But ultimately, you know, they don't bring me a lot of pleasure in the same way that my relationships with other people do. So I think if I was going to do the purple crayon route, it'd be mostly people and experiences.
That's cool.
You know?
One of the experiences that you shared in your about page that I absolutely loved your about page, but you said something about yard sales and flea markets. And so what is it about yard sales and flea markets that you just absolutely love?
Well, for one, it's a socially acceptable form of voyeurism. You get to peek into other people's lives because they're putting it out there on their driveway for you to go through. So, you know, you can learn a lot about somebody just by going through their, you know, their old jewelry or their vinyl or their books. But for me, yard sailing is something that we do as a family. So we get in the van on any given Saturday, and you know, we sort of map out where we want to go, and we look for places that have multiple yard sales in one location, or estate sales, or something like that. And it's just a great and inexpensive form of entertainment for everybody. And we get to spend, you know, the morning and the early afternoon together, just kind of exploring and finding cool little things and, you know, making deals. And, you know, we get back in the van, we say, so what'd you find? What'd you get? It's like, oh, I got this for a buck. Oh, it's like, oh, that's great. And, that's definitely a part of it. It's just family fun. But I also, I have a collection of, at home vintage packaging. So I'm always on the lookout for cool little packages or bottles or things like that, that people have just kind of excavated out of their basement. And, you know, I found some very, very interesting stuff, little tins, and sometimes with the items still in the tin, you know. You know, I've got a jar of Vaseline that I liberated from my wife's grandmother's closet that I'm pretty sure it dates back to 1948. I'm a little afraid to open it, yeah. Although it does have Vaseline still in it. So, but I just don't know what unearthly thing would come out of there if I unscrew the lid. So, but yeah, I mean, yard sales and flea markets are a great place to kind of, you know, dig up some of that stuff. But yeah, it's, you know, it's just a great way to spend a morning. And, you know, like I said, it's I get a chance to spend time with my family, and we just have these fun little inexpensive adventures.
Awesome. Well, Justin, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. It's been so much fun to just hear about your journey, hear about what you think about when you're designing. And I just really thank you for this time.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on. I thanks so much.
That does it for this episode of Getting Work to Work. Thank you so much to Justin for taking time to share about his work and career. I really had a great time. And thank you for taking the time to listen to Getting Work to Work. It means a lot to me that you're here. Would you be willing to share this podcast with your friends, other creative professionals, and entrepreneurs? You can send them to gwtw.co, where they can subscribe to Getting Work to Work, sign up for the Curiosity Lab, my weekly email newsletter, and find the various social media links, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, should they want to be social with me. You'll even find a link to my Patreon page where you can support my work here at Getting Work to Work, as well as future documentary projects and online courses. Would you like to be a guest on a future episode of Getting Work to Work, or know someone who should be on the show? Maybe you need some advice or just want to say hi. Drop me a line by sending me an email. I'm chris@chrismartinstudios.com. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.